This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This show is brought to you by Pfizer Malaysia, bringing science-based solutions to healthcare.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. I am Meera Sivasodhi. We live in a world free of smallpox. Few would remember this terrible disease and fewer still alive had seen it. But just 50 years ago, in the 1960s, parents lived in fear of smallpox killing or disfiguring their children. It was in 1966 that the World Health Organization launched the Global Smallpox Eradication Campaign, headed by Professor Donald Henderson.
For many parts of the world, vaccine was unknown. The first year of the program, we're dealing with 10 million cases worldwide, 2 million deaths. And there's nothing that's quite like that then or now that even comes close to that. The most vivid memory I have was in Dhaka in Bangladesh. We had the patients brought into a hospital. I was with a British physician who'd seen a lot of strange diseases in Africa, but never been in a ward with smallpox before. You walk in and the people have a pustular rash all over their face and also in the inside of their mouth, on their tongue. They have trouble swallowing. They have trouble drinking even. And the odor is like dead flesh. It just is a terrible odor that permeates. As we walked along looking at the patients, trying to see if they would say something to us, they'd look up at us with eyes that were just begging for help. They were in obvious pain. It was one of the most horrible experiences I've ever had. And at the end of the time, this English physician, he said to me, "I can never go through a ward again. It is such a horrible experience."
Smallpox was eradicated in 1980, a global victory that many thought impossible to reach or ridiculous to aim for. But almost two centuries earlier, in 1802, the same person who led our charge to vaccinate against smallpox had foreseen humanity's eventual triumph over the disease. He was Dr. Edward Jenner, the British physician who standardized and promoted vaccination. Jenner is also honored as the father of vaccination. Today, we tell his story. But first, a fun fact.
Jenner became a fellow of the Royal Society at quite a young age. And you'd think that Jenner, the father of vaccination, would have been made an FRS for his discoveries in medicine, particularly vaccination. But it wasn't that at all.
What was it for?
He got his FRS because he worked out how the cuckoo chick got rid of the other chicks and eggs in the nest.
Right. Let's start. Jenner was born on the 17th of May, 1749, in the small farming town of Berkeley in southwest England.
The Jenners started out as bakers, but by the time Jenner came along, his father was the vicar in Berkeley, so they'd gone up the social scale. So he was born in the vicarage. His house became the vicarage.
That was Dr. Tim Wallington, chair of the Jenner Trust. Jenner's house in Berkeley is now the Jenner Museum, where Wallington had volunteered for over 20 years.
It's a fairly large country house in a nice garden in a country town that was to do with the dairy industry. You walk 100 yards, you're in fields.
Jenner's parents died when he was 5, and 8 years old, he was sent to a boarding school.
During Jenner's day and a couple of centuries before that, smallpox was one of the greatest killers. And across most of the world, it killed about one person in 12. So the average person in most countries had about a 1 in 3 chance of getting smallpox during their lifetime. Most of his victims were children under the age of 5.
Unfortunately, a smallpox outbreak occurred and all boys at Jenner's boarding school had to receive what was then the most effective way of preventing smallpox, variolation. Jenner experienced smallpox for the first time. Professor Gareth William, author of the book Angel of Death, The Story of Smallpox, explains variolation, a common practice during Jenner's time.
Now, variola, it's the name of the smallpox disease in Latin. And what variolation was, it sounds absolutely crazy, but you take smallpox pus from the blisters of somebody who's actually got smallpox. You take a small amount and you scratch it into the skin of a healthy child. So you're actually deliberately inoculating them with this killer disease, smallpox. But the remarkable thing is that if you do that with a tiny dose from somebody with mild smallpox, you've actually got a very good chance of giving the child a very mild dose so that they might come out in a couple of hundred blisters. They might look pretty bad for a couple of days, but they get better. And the risks of dying from artificial smallpox, if you like, were only about 1 in 50 instead of 1 in 4 if you caught it in real life. This was actually, for the day, a very safe and very effective medical procedure. And it was a procedure that English doctors made a lot of money out of.
English doctors would take the boys out into the stables to keep them nice and cold. According to accounts, bled them and purged them repeatedly, fed a small diet dose to sweeten the blood, then received a smallpox pus and let the virus run its course for a fortnight.
Then at the end of all this, Pearl Jenner, the age of 8, was so weak that he could barely stand. He had quite a bad dose of smallpox. He wasn't scarred, but he was left mentally scarred by what had happened. And it was very bad for him, but it's been very good for the rest of us, because this is probably one of the things that made him realize that something had to be better than variolation. So when he was thinking of doing his experiments with vaccination, I think in the back of his mind was always the notion that this was going to be something much better than variolation.
Four years after his horrible variolation experience, Jenner took up medical apprenticeship under Dr. Daniel Ludlow. With Ludlow, Jenner learned the medical practice of the time.
Nasty, dangerous stuff, most of it. Bleeding people, purging people, all sorts of stuff that didn't make people better, really. But the really important thing about Jenner, of course, is that after he'd finished that, he went off to London to be apprenticed to John Hunter. And Hunter was a true scientist.
Jenner's medical apprenticeship served him well, for he was apparently quite a capable country doctor. After his time in London, he returned to Berkeley to practice, doing house calls on horseback.
He did a lot of prescribing of the drugs of the day. He would have used bloodletting a lot as a therapeutic measure. So if you turned up with almost anything, Jenner would either stick leeches on your arm, which again was one of the treatments used for smallpox, but leeches were used to treat other things as well. He would also do operations, and in his diary there's an account of a local farmer who had managed to rupture his abdomen, so there were intestines everywhere, and Jenner had put him on the kitchen table, pushed everything back inside and stitched them up, and amazingly the man survived. So Jenner did some pretty heroic medicine, as well as stuff that was pretty commonplace for doctors of the day.
Up next, we follow Jenner as he developed into a scientist and promoted vaccination worldwide. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, I'm Mira Sivasodhi, and you're listening to Health and Living, brought to you by Pfizer Malaysia. Today we tell the story of Edward Jenner, the British physician honoured as the father of vaccination. Fortunately for us, John Hunter himself, extraordinary surgeon to the king, trained Edward Jenner to do more than treat the body. He encouraged Jenner's curiosity of the natural world and taught his young apprentice to experiment. He moulded Jenner into a scientist.
Taught him the scientific method. Observe the world, develop ideas as to how it's working, put your ideas to the test of experiment.
A man of many interests and spurred by John Hunter, Edward Jenner also collected and tasted whale's milk, designed hydrogen balloons, fertilized black currants with human blood clots, and tested how hedgehogs hibernate.
The particular experiments Jenner was involved in were body temperature measurements. Hunter supplied the apparatus. Jenner had the hedgehogs because he was out in the country. And it was a matter of seeing how their temperature changed. So this was scientific observation. The hypothesis being that in order to survive the winter, their rate of body activity, of metabolism, would have to slow. And with that, their temperature would fall. And Jenner was the person that did the recordings of the temperature inside the hibernating hedgehogs. The key point there is observation. You observe that hedgehogs hibernate. You wonder what's happening to their physiology, to the way they're working when they hibernate. You have an idea, a hypothesis, that their metabolism will slow, and that a consequence of that, you might find evidence of that in their temperature. So the science bit, having developed that idea, is to make the observations, see whether you're right or not, record what you've done. And all of that is there in the hedgehog work with Hunter.
Jenner's curiosity and scientific skills also helped him unravel how a cuckoo bird chick ends up alone in the nest of another bird.
He and his rather lazy nephew had staked out lots of birds' nests around where he lived. Jenner really went into the story.
June 18th, 1787, I examined the nest of the hedge sparrow, which then contained a cuckoo and three sparrow's eggs. The little cuckoo, with the assistance of its rump and wings, contrived to get the sparrow chick upon its back, clambered backward with it up to the side of the nest till it reached the top. It threw off its load with a jerk and disengaged it from the nest.
It sounds very trivial, but in fact it was only filmed in Nature relatively recently. That this was a huge puzzle that had worried the ancient scientists in Greece and Rome. And how the cuckoo chick ended up just on its own in the nest was one of the great mysteries of nature, and something that Jenner was able to solve.
So when Edward Jenner was made a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1789, it wasn't Jenner the doctor who received recognition, but Jenner the scientist. The same scientist who 9 years later in 1798 shouted out loud to everyone that we could stop smallpox by using just tiny bits of another virus, the cowpox.
We don't exactly know how Jenner latched onto cowpox. The story that everybody knows is that when he was a medical apprentice, he met a milkmaid, and she allegedly said to him, "Well, I've had cowpox. You don't need to worry about me getting smallpox because I'm never going to get it." And Jenner, he'd never heard of it. So the milkmaid explained that if you had a little cut in your hand and when you were milking, the infection got into your skin, so you'd end up with a blister, a bit like the one on the cow. So you had cowpox. You'd feel pretty unwell for a couple of days and you'd get a temperature. But after that, it would all settle down. And if you'd had cowpox, you were then protected miraculously against smallpox.
Others suspect that Jenner might have heard of cowpox from his colleagues, particularly one John Fuster.
One of Jenner's colleagues, Fuster, he was the doctor in the next town. He had a business inoculating the local population with smallpox.
Recall that many people at the time protected themselves against smallpox by scraping bits of smallpox virus into themselves, a procedure called variolation or inoculation.
And he's the chap that made the observation that quite a proportion of those people from the dairy industry, he couldn't make the smallpox virus take. And it's probably through that observation that's the basis of Jenner going forward and observing just that. That kind of thing is recorded in the inquiry and the experiment he ends up doing on James.
Regardless of how Jenner suspected that cowpox could protect against smallpox, the idea clearly fascinated him.
Very interesting. It took Jenner about 30 years to get on and do his experiments that led to the publication of his paper on vaccination. And during that time, he talked about the notion that cowpox might protect against smallpox with his fellow doctors, and they just didn't believe it. In fact, they threatened to throw him out of one of their medical clubs because he kept on talking about this and they didn't want to hear any of it.
Over the years, Jenner collected records of people who had had cowpox and were not affected by smallpox. In 1798, he published these records in his seminal book, The Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of Variole Vaccine, to support his argument that inserting cowpox into the body could prevent smallpox. However, his experiment in which he took cowpox from a milkmaid, Sarah Nilmes, and applied it onto a young boy called James Pip, presented the strongest evidence. He conducted the experiment in his Berkeley house, which is the Jenner Museum today.
So the routine in James's case, the son of a labourer who worked for Jenner, would have been to inoculate him with smallpox proper. So the experiment that Jenner did was inoculate him with cowpox first, following the hypothesis that that would induce immunity to smallpox.
I selected a healthy boy, about 8 years old, for the purpose of the inoculation of the cowpox. The matter was taken from a sore on the hand of a dairymaid who was infected by her master's cow, and it was inserted on the 14th of May, 1796, into the arm of the boy by two superficial incisions. But now listen to the most delightful part of my story. The boy has since been inoculated with smallpox, which, as I predicted, produced no effect. I shall now pursue my experiments with redoubled vigour.
And that was his evidence that he'd achieved immunity through cowpox to smallpox.
But Jenner could not, and he did not, claim credit for vaccination. About 20 years before Jenner's experiment, another farmer further south, Benjamin Jetsey, had successfully vaccinated his family with cowpox. And remember that 30 years earlier, John Fuster had noted that cowpox protected against smallpox.
There's a lot of speculation as to why Fuster didn't try it. The usual speculation is that he didn't try it because he'd got a good business in old-fashioned inoculation. Benjamin Jetsey just tried it. There's no body of observation. He was following the local law, tried it on his wife and kids, and that was it. Another important thing about the Jenner discovery, that Jenner was the first person in terms of recorded science to demonstrate that you could transfer cowpox from person to person. Originally, it was the person-to-person transfer of the virus that got it round the world. And Jenner tried various things. He used to dry the pus from the pustules onto silk threads and various other things of that kind. But they must have been very hit and miss.
What Jenner did was to describe the background in ways that anybody could understand, then describe how to do vaccination and how to tell whether it had worked. Anybody who could afford 7 shillings and sixpence could buy a copy of Jenner's Inquiry and basically set up as a vaccinator themselves. So this was effectively a do-it-yourself guide to vaccination. This was hugely different from standard medical practice at the time. Back then, most doctors, whenever they thought of something, it became a patent recipe. So it became a secret, which they guarded very jealously indeed.
Jenner's own countrymen, however, resisted vaccination.
English people rejected, at least some of them rejected, Jenner's amazing discovery. Jenner was very good at making friends, but he was also personally quite good at making enemies. He was very self-centered. He believed that vaccination was absolutely perfect. And although he was quite a quiet chap in some ways, I think he probably got people's backs up by believing that his invention could not be bettered. The other thing was there were a lot of people making large amounts of money out of variolation and out of treating smallpox. So if you've got somebody who comes along with an invention which is going to stop smallpox from happening, then you just see Jenner and vaccination as a threat to your income stream.
But vaccination spread rapidly across the world.
Vaccination spread very rapidly around England, even though it met resistance in some places. And very quickly it spread to France and Switzerland. The Spanish king got to hear of it and he arranged for vaccination to be taken around the world to the Spanish colonies. It was picked up very quickly in America, then Russia. The thing that caused it to spread were, first of all, the excitement, the possibility that this awful speckled monster might be held at bay, a procedure that was obviously safer than variolation, and also the fact that it was very simple and easy to do.
Various expeditions where sailing ships went off with a suitable complement of orphans on them, and they were vaccinated two by two as the voyage proceeded, in the hope that you'd end up with some with live, you know, with active lesions when you got the other end, and could propagate the virus from then on.
Within 3 years of the inquiry, over 100,000 people had been vaccinated. Countries began to enforce vaccination by law. Inquiries and requests for vaccination materials poured in from far corners of the world. Jenner responded with passion, sending samples of his cowpox virus to start vaccination elsewhere. Up till his death to a stroke in 1823, Jenner promoted vaccination locally and globally.
By the end of Jenner's life, he could look around the planet and see proof of concept, if you like, that vaccination worked not only to protect the individual, but again, if you did it on a large scale, you could actually squeeze the virus out and into extinction.
Almost 200 years after the inquiry in 1980, we finally realized Jenner's vision and eradicated smallpox. Several key technical breakthroughs helped push the last charge against smallpox into remote tropical areas. But it was the people who led the charge, the vaccinators, who denied Mission Impossible. Donald Henderson recalls his smallpox eradication team.
We did recruit quite a number of young people in their 20s, 30s. They would work day and night. They'd be swept away in the enthusiasm. It was amazing that many of them would just not take a break even. So they were in the field, sleeping in villages, eating the food, what have you. Once a month, we brought everybody together for 2 days, strategic sessions, and then said, you know, take a day of rest. And many of them really resented this 2 days out and would argue with us about it. You know, we've got a lot to do. We can't waste our time this way. They would eat in the village with the people, talk with the people, which itself made a real difference. The young people, that they just plunged in and are absolutely amazing. What they didn't know was that this was impossible to do. So they thought all the time that they could achieve it.
To achieve what most others think impossible requires unshakable belief. Some light hobby and humor also helps. Not only could Edward Jenner vaccinate, he also sang well, played the flute and violin, and wrote poetries. We end our story of Edward Jenner with one of his poems about the death of a Dr. Waite, who made medical gingerbread for killing intestinal worms. Gareth William reads for us. I'm Meera Sivasothi, and you have been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Begins with the Latin names of some of the worms. Ascarides, Teres, Lumbrici, and all, ye chyle-sucking insects that tremblingly crawl, no more be afraid, you're quite safe in our guts, for Waite has done making his gingerbread nuts.
This show is brought to you by Pfizer Malaysia, bringing science-based solutions to healthcare.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.